Good afternoon. We'll call the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. It's March 26, 2012. We do have a quorum here today. Present to my left, co-chair Senator Wagner, Senator Stedman, to my right, Senator French, and soon joining us will be Senator Wilikowski. Both Senator Stevens and Senator McGuire are excused today. During this hearing, we have three items that are on our agenda. First, the committee will hear a brief presentation of Christia Chudzak, Assistant Commissioner of Canada's Federal Northern Pipeline Agency, and she will be presenting about Canada's preparation for the pipeline to transport North Slope gas to markets in the lower 48. So that's our first matter on the agenda. Welcome to all three of you. Second, we will have Scott Hayworth, CEO of Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority, also known as ANGDA, and from members of his team, and they will provide testimony relating to SB 215, which is a Gas Line Development Corporation, which is a in-state gas line pipeline. Finally, the committee will hear public testimony relating to SB 209, which are development plans for oil and gas leases. And the committee plans to devote approximately 30 minutes to each of the three agenda items today. And it is not my intent that we will be moving any of the bills today. We do welcome Senator Wilikowski. But with that, we formally would welcome Chris Chudzak. If everyone could officially state their name and affiliation, and then so we make sure we know who is on the record.
Thank you very much, Senator. My name is Chris Chudzak, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of the Northern Pipeline Agency in Canada.
Frank Richards, Deputy Federal Coordinator with the Office of the Federal Coordinator for the Natural Gas Transportation Projects.
Peter Taylor, Consular of Canada in Anchorage, Alaska.
Welcome to all three of you, and so please, the floor is yours. Tell us about what Canada is doing with respect to the large diameter pipe.
Thank you very much, Chair and Senators. I noticed some faces that were in attendance at the Lunch and Learn this afternoon, so I'm going to try and shorten my presentation a bit to allow for a little bit more time for questions and answers. Bonjour tout le monde was what I was asked to say. So welcome. I'm very pleased to be here in Alaska. And what I'm going to do is talk very quickly about how Canada is preparing for the Alaska Gas Highway Pipeline Project, should it go ahead. So I'm going to talk very quickly about some of the challenges, how we're getting ready, how we're engaging our key players, and where we're leading, and finish off with a couple of next steps that we will be pursuing. So the biggest question on the table for us and for the state of Alaska, and I think even for the producers, is the commercial uncertainty around the project. Clearly, this is a commercially, if the project will only go ahead if it's commercially viable, if the markets want it, and if the producers seek and find successfully securing customers for it. Now, within this rubric, basically, we view the project as being the same. Its purpose continues to be to ship natural gas from the North Slope through Alaska, the Yukon, northeastern BC, and into the lower 48. Its footprint is essentially the same. It's the same route. There's no new land being sought. And its scope continues to be the same. Its operational infrastructure has not changed. But the context against which decisions are being taken has in the last 35 years. Technology advances have enabled pipeline technology to become more sophisticated, pumping more gas through more safe pipeline, more safe materials through smaller pipe at a higher pressure, for example. New environmental laws have come into play in Canada and elsewhere. For example, the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act exists now, but didn't 35 years ago. This has an impact on how we regulate and how we make decisions around large-scale resource projects and other projects. Society's values have also shifted. For example, we now place value on traditional knowledge that's gleaned from Aboriginal people, from First Nations, that's used in the process of our regulatory decision-making in Canada with regard to the development of projects of this nature. And clearly, there are new market pressures at play. Shale, Asia, and liquefied natural gas, or LNG, and LNG. So these are clearly pressures and are helping to create a different environmental, socioeconomic, and often political environment. Now, I'm here to tell you that Canada is ready to proceed should this project become commercially viable. And this slide I particularly like because it lays out the three buckets of assets that we bring to the table, that are brought to bear on this project to the table. The first set of assets are existing instruments, legal instruments that have been granted throughout the last 35 years on this project. The first asset is a treaty. We have an international treaty with the government of the United States. This is an important instrument because it's the only pipeline project of its only pipeline project, rather, that is the subject of an international treaty. And with that brings special obligations and responsibilities on both sides to fulfill. Secondly, we have as a consequence of that treaty, we have the Northern Pipeline Act, which is a piece of legislation that actually creates our agency, the Northern Pipeline Agency. And what it does is it gathers all the authorities from various different departments in the Government of Canada and centralizes them in a single window place, a single agency to make decisions on this pipeline. And that's quite important. Third, in 1978, the Government of Canada issued certificates of public convenience to this project. So the project's been approved, unlike the U.S. version of the project, which is under debate in terms of whether it will go ahead and whether the companies will file under FERC. And also, finally, in terms of existing instruments, the company has in its possession an easement with the government of the Yukon for the corridor through the Yukon. So that's a bucket of instruments that are quite important in terms of an asset base for moving forward, should that decision be taken. The second bucket of assets is that fact that Canada is an experienced regulator in this project. We regulated Stage 1 back in the late 70s, early 80s. We have experience in the environmental assessment process. And as part of that, we've attached 750 terms and conditions to the certificates that are extensively prescribed. And finally, we have an efficient regulatory framework. This single window model that consolidates all federal authorities under one roof is unique in Canada and is actually looked upon to a certain extent as being a model for the future. And we also in our agency have the responsibility government-wide for consulting with First Nations. Now, this slide just gives you a bit of a hint of how we're setting up our regulatory framework using the existing Northern Pipeline Act legal model. But the biggest challenge for us has been how do we update information over the last 30 years related to the economy, to the environment, and to society? Because as I mentioned before, things have changed. So we're using the Act and we're invoking the process of striking advisory councils that will be struck both in the Yukon and in northeastern BC. And they will conduct a public review process that will speak to and enable the public to contribute their ideas as to what needs to be updated. And at the end, a report will be put forward to the minister, and the minister will be able to act on that report. Now, this doesn't happen unless there are relationships that have been built and individuals and groups and governments have been engaged. And this slide simply tells you and explains to all of us that, in fact, Canada has been engaged in this process since 1978, with different types of engagement as the project has grown and gotten smaller. And this includes working, as I mentioned, with industry and the public in general, regionally and locally, as well as with government partners, including First Nations, the governments of the Yukon and British Columbia, and the government of the United States. And I want to highlight two specific areas of importance for us. First, in terms of our relationship with First Nations, we have a special fiduciary obligation with regard to Aboriginal people on the part of the Crown. We have a moral and a legal obligation to consult when their issues and their interests impact on their rights. And our agency is responsible for these consultations on behalf of the Government of Canada. There are approximately 30-plus First Nations along the pipeline corridor route in the Yukon and in BC. Some have settled land claims, others don't. But the law in our case requires that we make sure that these interests are taken into account when we make any decision of material impact on the project. And just finally, as a last point, the slide says we build capacity for long-term community growth and self-sufficiency. In Canada, we have taken the decision to fund First Nation, certain First Nation groups with through grants and contributions that will allow these communities to build the human capacity to be able to deal with us and also others. The next group that we've revitalized our engagement with is yourselves through the State of Alaska and the Government of the United States. through this longstanding treaty. And one of the points I'd just like to highlight here, we feel that this is a very important part of how we fulfill our treaty obligations, simply because the building of good, strong relationships between both jurisdictions allows us to understand each other's perspective, our regulatory perspectives and processes more clearly, and be able to advance the project should it proceed more expeditiously on both sides of the border. So where are we leading to? We're streamlining pipeline regulation. We're invoking modern business practices in our own agency to ensure that we're modernized, we're technologically up to date, and we are able to collaborate in a timely, real-time way. And we're moving towards securing tangible outcomes. So what are these outcomes looking like? In our view, there are six, and they're key to meeting our goals in terms of the treaty and our obligations on the project. First is to meet and exceed environmental standards and socioeconomic standards through a smart process that's collaborative. We respect existing federal approvals. Those approvals I indicated were in those buckets of assets I described. We will ensure that there's safe pipeline design and construction through transparent, public, and thoughtful process in the regulatory phase. We will try and secure maximum economic benefits by encouraging these business relationships between the proponents and First Nations and local communities. We will meet our duty to consult Aboriginal peoples by strengthening how we consult and how frequently we consult. And finally, we are engaging the public and industry through a timely and predictable process. And finally, what's ahead? Well, we can't predict the commercial direction of this project, clearly, but we are preparing for the future, and that's why I'm here to describe what we're doing. And we believe that this is what it takes to support long-term growth and job creation both in Canada and in North America. And we ultimately believe that this is the type of activity that will unleash North America's natural resources advantage. So with that, Senators, thank you. Merci. And Gunal Shia Shadi.
Senator Stedman has a question.
Several. Mr. Chairman, it's nice to see our neighbors from Canada come down and give us a little update on what's going on just across the mountainside here. Some of our colleagues in the legislature sometimes think Southeast Alaska should be given back to Canada. Or given to Canada. But anyway,
only if the price is right.
we are part of the state, but just on the McKinsey line, could you give us just kind of an update, because it's hard to follow the news. We get so wrapped up in our own major, you know, AGEA process and TransCanada, Exxon. And we know that, Exxon is involved in McKinsey, and if you could give us kind of an update on the status of McKinsey, and then I want to talk a little bit about some potential oil and gas lines that aren't on your map on page 8, which would be the export lines going into West BC.
Through the chair, thank you, Senator. Just in terms of McKinsey, my colleague would it be in a better position to give you that kind of update than I would in terms of that specific project? And you'd like to go back to the fifth, the yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah, number 8, please.
Sure. Okay.
Okay. There's been a lot of discussion at Energy Council over the years, and we've been watching the escalation in the oil sands as far as going from, well, a couple of years ago it was like 1.5 million. Now it's around 2 million, forecast to go to 4 million barrels a day in oil exports. And there's proposals to bring gas to the West Coast to export in the export market through, West Coast BC, Kitimat, and potentially oil lines for export. And I was just wondering if you have any updates on that or kind of what's going on with those projects. And earlier when you were out, I was asking about McKinsey, if we could get an update on the McKinsey line a little more specific. We are a little bit familiar with the project because the basins are connected and the projects have some similarities. So maybe we can get some of those updates. It'd be nice.
Okay. Senator, I'll do my best given that I haven't entirely been in the conversation. First of all, on the McKinsey line, My understanding is that they got their essential regulatory approval last year, but that in terms of something happening, they are laboring under exactly the same considerations as Alaska is, which is that the market in the lower 48, because, I mean, the situation broadly, and I think you probably know this as well or better than I do, is that Canada is already exporting gas to the U.S., mostly from Alberta, but from Alberta and B.C. There are a couple of major shale gas plays in northeastern B.C. that are now online starting to feed into the system. So, you know, we have a surplus of gas. Somebody was asking earlier where we needing Alaska gas to produce the oil sands, and my understanding is not in the near future. But my understanding about the Mackenzie line is they have a very important asset in terms of their regulatory approval, but they don't have any more than Alaska does the kind of what you call precedent agreements with mm-hmm. suppliers that would allow the proponents, and of course TransCanada is involved in both. They don't have anything that allows them to build a very expensive line in the north. So that's all I have. I mean, I believe, I'm not sure whether you're referring to some comments that Bob McLeod, the new premier of the Northwest Territories, I know I got some calls somewhere about late November, early December last year, because Premier McLeod was talking about the Mackenzie Valley line and I think he was trying to talk it up, because I have not seen any indication that there are commercial contracts that allow them to build a line. On I think your other question was more broadly about, you know, Canada exports from Canada to the U.S., exports elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're your largest energy supplier, largest supplier of natural gas in terms of foreign suppliers. If we, I mean, some of my American friends go, oh, but we don't mean you as a foreign supplier. Well, mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, but, and of course, we're supplying over 2.5 million barrels of oil, most of it, increasing proportion is oil sands oil, most of it going all of it going to lower 48, and it gets shut in at Cushing, Oklahoma, and therefore the discussion of Keystone XL. There is, of course, as you referred to, a talk of an oil pipeline to Kitimat to basically to export oil to world markets, meaning just as Alaskans tend to mean Asia. My comment there would be simply a statement of fact. This is something my Prime Minister and his Energy Minister have mentioned a number of times as a question of diversification from almost total dependence on the U.S. market. But it's also a matter of fact simply that line it's a concept that was at Enbridge, I think, have, but it's not a line that has been built. It's not a line on which all of the consultations with First Nations and others have taken place. They're gearing up to have those consultations, but the regulatory process is nowhere near there. So another honored member of this body was, I think, picking up something Senator Murkowski said, which is if they're going to be exporting oil from Kitimat, that tanker traffic is going awfully close to Alaskan waters. And the question was about single-hulled ships. And I promptly went and sent an email to a friend in Transport Canada who said, well, Peter, technically they're correct at the moment, but since Canada is going to be requiring double-hulled tankers by 2015, there's no prospect that any oil, if shipped from Kitimat, would be being shipped in single-hull tankers, because there's going to be no oil to ship from Kitimat before we require double-hull. So that's kind of my broad update. Did I cover most of what you needed?
Yes, you did. And just as a quick comment, you know, we're always struggling here in Southeast with trying to increase the trade traffic with Prince Rupert, because it's so close to us. And now with the new port in Prince Rupert and the rail line, we're hoping that, you know, that there'd be some synergies that we could, you know, take advantage of with the fast growth there in Prince Rupert. And also, if I can just make a brief comment on the potential export of oil through Kitimat, I'm pretty confident that BC and Southeast Alaska would be working in conjunction with some form of spill response and staging and those type of things, dealing with the sensitive waters in both both sides of Dixon Entrance. So, I mean, that's, we're kind of, I guess, getting ahead of ourselves here, because there's a long ways to go to get the line built and export. But I can certainly see Canada's interest in exporting, you know, some of that oil sands because of the mass volume that is going to be produced. So I think Southeast would be very, and the state of Alaska would be very open to discussions on dealing with those type of environmental issues or constraints if we're dealing with tugboat staging or what have you, trying to get around Queen Charlotte, assuming that, I don't know if the ships would be going north or south, but either way into the coast, watching the tides and currents.
First of all, through the chair, we'd just like to say that we've already had the Coast Guard raise, you know, the issue of tanker traffic, which is, you know, quite a few years away, I suspect, saying that this is a significant concern. So you're quite right, Senator, that the relevant authorities are very much apprised of it and will not let the rest of us forget. I actually, Mr. Chair, may I address a question about... So a question about the Alaska economy. May I address it to the case the senators have some expertise, and I'm thinking a little bit of Senator Stedman in particular.
Sure.
Okay. One of the curious things about the Canadian trade statistics with Alaska is we export petroleum and coal products, and we're definitely not exporting coal to Alaska. So I'm presuming, in fact, that there are some way, you know, there are some times when the Alaska refineries or here in Southeast, where presumably you buy from wherever you can get it, and it's just because there's several hundred thousand dollars worth of petroleum products being exported, and I assume it's just spot prices of gas and diesel and, you know, lubricating whatever some part of Alaska needs that there is not supplied from an American or an Alaskan refinery. Does anybody know about such traffic?
I think it more comes into Anchorage.
Okay.
They're dealing with Anchorage Airport and other areas. Southeast, we end up getting most of our fuel products from Cherry Point in Washington, and on occasions they'll bring product in from other areas, but mostly, it's my understanding, it's Alaska oil that goes to Cherry Point in Washington to be refined and then shipped back, just because we don't have the mass of population to warrant construction of refineries. Frankly, in Alaska, we've struggled with that here. Why don't we refine our own products more? And why is our cost of fuel oil so high? We've struggled with that. But if there's, and I have no idea if Canada's looking at, doing refineries on BC or not, but Prince Rupert and Kitimat substantially closer than Cherry Point.
Senator French, did you have a question?
Just a quick one, Mr. Chairman. Obviously, shale gas has had a big impact on our big pipeline. What effect has it had on Alberta? How much less or more gas is Alberta exporting to the United States since the advent of the shale gas revolution in the lower 48?
Through the chair, Senator French, the honest answer is I don't know. But it's fairly clear that they are producing shale gas in BC and putting it into the system. Now, that system, as we all know, supplies large chunks of urban Canada, but also chunks of the urban U.S. and in the Midwest and elsewhere. And I simply don't know if natural gas exports have gone up or down. I haven't heard of anything that make me think they've gone down radically. I understand the logic, and I just don't have a clear answer for you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You know, when it comes to this specific 1,700-mile pipeline from the North Slope into Canada, you know, recently the U.S. Federal Coordinator's office budget was significantly cut. What is the status of the Canadian government's budget for this project?
Thank you. Currently, our budget reference levels for the agency is $1.3 million annually. On top of that, we have approximately $1.2 million grants contributions fund for First Nations. So those would be grants that would be applied for and given out to various First Nation communities for capacity building. So that on average, that's what our budget is. There will be a federal budget that will be tabled in Parliament this Thursday. By the Minister of Finance, and we will see what the Minister says and does.
Senator
Wagoner.
Yes.
I get that way too once in a while. Single window model. Tell me a little more about the single window model.
Through the chair.
How long it's been in effect, how it's been working.
Sure. The agency is a single window model. It was created in 1978 through an act of parliament that gave effect to the treaty as well. And basically, in a nutshell, what it does is it takes various federal departments that have pieces of legislation that impact on the regulatory process, Fisheries Act, for example, permitting, Transport Act, and delegates them to the minister responsible. In our case, at this point, it's the Minister of Natural Resources. And in doing that delegation, he and as we go forward with the project, our agency would be making decisions on the regulatory side through that window. So we would have the authority on behalf of the Minister of Transport, for example, to take decisions on the transportation of what have you in the context. So instead of having four ministers or five ministers out there making separate decisions that are coordinated but not integrated, we have a single minister that does it for all.
So, and that minister could be different for different projects?
This model only exists for this specific project.
Where can we get more information? I want to send this to our people in Washington, D.C.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Mr. Richards.
Co-Chair Wagner, in 1976, Congress produced the Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Act, and in that act, it gave what was then called the Office of the Federal Inspector that same single window authority. So that office then had the various other federal regulatory agencies working under it. So that single office made those determined decisions on those regulatory permits. That law was changed in the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act in 2004, and our office was stripped of that single window authority. So we have had that previously, but Congress made the change in 2004.
I'm thinking of a more overall encompassing program that this would make a good model for. So where would I find this, an organizational layout for this process?
From the Canadian standpoint, we would have the legislation would lay that out. The law would lay that out. So we can put you through, if you come to our website, we can make the connection for you. But the legislation lays out what the model is.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And just generally as part of a wrap-up, you know, I'm mm-hmm. intrigued by the portion of your presentation where it went shale, 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 Asia, Asia, Asia. And, you know, certainly that brings to mind, you know, the assessment of both the Canadian and U.S. Shale potential and also the potential for the design of Canadian pipeline systems. Go. What generally is it that you're hearing or talking about in Canada when it comes to shale, 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 and Asia, Asia, Asia?
Well, Senator, for my roles and role and responsibility with respect to this agency and project, simply what we're hearing is what you're hearing as well in the marketplace is the potential of an LNG option here in Alaska as one of the various competing proposals that Alaskans are grappling with. And so that's part of our mix and understanding whether or not this project will go ahead in the future. But to wrap up, and ultimately, it's a commercial decision. It'll be the producers who decide. And I'm just here to say that, you know, Canada's prepared to move forward if that decision is taken.
Seeing no further questions, if you have a concluding remark or any comments, certainly it would be well received. If not,
yes, thank you very much. Just I would like to thank the the legislature for allowing me to have the opportunity to come and address you, and especially you, Senator, for having helped to organize, allowed your office to organize the Lunch and Learn this afternoon. It was a terrific opportunity for us to get our message across, and certainly a great welcome for me to Alaska, so thank you very much.
Thank you for coming, and certainly we've had good relationships with Canada for many, many decades, and my one of my daughters a year ago married a Canadian, so we're sure the relationship's going to continue. So anyway, thank you very much. We'll take a brief at ease while we transition into Senate Bill 215. Brief at ease. Now, come back on the record. Welcome back. Again, as continuation of our Monday, March 26th presentation. We now have Mr. Scott Hayworth, CEO, Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority. Scott, are you available?
Yes, I am, Senator.
Please state your name and affiliation, and then we look forward to your comments regarding Senate Bill 215.
Well, thank you for interviewing me, or inviting me, excuse me. This is Scott Hayworth. I'm the current chairman of the board of ANGDA, the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority, and I wouldn't want to be the CEO, sir. Thank you. But thanks for the promotion, but I'll take a pass on that one.
Okay.
You've asked us, Senator, I'm watching the screen, Senator Pascal. I don't see Senator Rogers isn't there, right?
I didn't hear that.
It's just you that's there, Senator Pascal, and I see Senator Wagner and Senator French.
And Senator French and Senator Stedman just walked out just for a moment, and we expect to be rejoined by Senator Wilikowski.
I see Senator Hollis French. Okay, great. Thank you very much. What I thought I would do, all I can say is that Grier Hopkins, Senator Thomas's aide, asked us to come before you today and testify. I am here. I have two contractors with me. One is online from Eagle River, and another one, O.D. Sather, is online up at the Fairbanks LIO. I thought I'd just quickly give you an overview of what ANGDA has done with the B2F project, as it's known, and then we can take your questions and do our best to answer anything that you need answered. If you remember, it was about 4 years ago that then-Governor Sarah Palin had a press conference, had ANGDA there and NSTAR, and asked us to do this, quote, project, which was to run a gas line from Cook Inlet up to Fairbanks. We had one meeting with NSTAR. That was the one, only, and last meeting with NSTAR. They pulled away from the project. The governor had asked us to do it. We continued. We were looking, and they asked us to look at the Glenn Richardson TAPS corridor route. We went that way because we felt, with very little study, that had the most populations, three military bases, a utility, Golden Valley, a refinery, Flint Hills, and other cities of that nature. We already had in our possession and had done earlier, received the state unconditional right-of-way lease from Glen Allen to Palmer. So we already had the piece from Palmer to Glen Allen done, and it's very easy to work in the existing TAPS corridor. So that made it very easy. By the way, that right-of-way has been valued at about $12 million in a recent LBNA audit. So that's an asset we bring to the table. We ran out of funding soon. People didn't want us to do it for whatever reasons, political, it doesn't matter. We were not able to finish. We can go into more detail if you need on that. But we did complete, I believe, 80 to 90% of that route, and my two contractors that we have with us can fill in all the blanks that I may have left out. I hope that helps. Thank you.
Question for you. There was a December 2009 report, and in that report it stated, quote, there are sufficient additional natural gas reserves in the Cook Inlet region for development and delivery to Fairbanks via the B2F pipeline. Therefore, the supply of gas to existing consumers of Cook Inlet natural gas would not be adversely impacted, close quote. Do you believe that statement continues to be true? And elaborate
really
on that.
Interesting when I think about it, because I couldn't say, this is Scott's talking, I couldn't say who put that in there or how much faith I might have had in that statement 4 years ago. I knew there was, it's always been said that it's different amounts. One year it's 10 trillion cubic feet left to find. I think recently it's up as high as 18 or 19. But today I would have to strongly say I believe there's plenty of gas in Cook Inlet. This Escapeta Fury find, they say it's 3.5 TCF. If they were off by 66%, that'd still leave you 1.15, and that's 10 or 15 years of gas in Cook Inlet at the current rates. As you gentlemen all know, there's supposed to be a total of 3 jackup rigs working this summer in Cook Inlet. And I have to say, what happens if they get lucky like Fury did, Escapeta Fury, and strike a big find on the very first well? So with 3 jackup rigs up there, or out there in other land-based smaller rigs working, there's a good chance this summer we could find a lot more gas and Cook Inlet. And I've always said, in my role as a board member of ANGDA for years, what's the worst nightmare that could happen to a driller explorer in Cook Inlet, and that nightmare is to find 6, 5, or 10 trillion cubic feet, because how do they sell it? How do they monetize it?
All right, Senator Wagner has a question.
A little bit of correction. When we heard Wednesday from Fury, from Damon Katie, their estimate now is down to 750 Bs a day. And they still haven't flow tested the well or done a lot of logs on it or anything. Secondly, there's not 3 jackup rigs this summer. There's going to be 2, Scott. So there's going to be the Spartan.
Senator Wagner, hi, this is Scott. Well, you just full of good news there. I had not heard either one of those things. So thank you, and we'll state it more correctly henceforth.
Yeah. There will be the Endeavor, which is the jack-up rig going to be brought to the inlet by Buccaneer. There will be the Spartan 151, which is the rig Fury currently has under lease until, I think it's 2015.
So. Senator Wagner, through the chair, if I may, what happened to the third rig that we've heard about for months and months? And that's disappointing to hear that they're lowering their estimate to 750. That's disappointing. But what happened, sir, if I could ask you?
There never was a third rig that I've ever known about. It's always been the Escapeta jackup and the Buccaneer. I don't know of anybody
else.
Well,
then I err, and thank you for correcting me.
You know, possibly you could elaborate a little more on potentially why the B2F, and that's Beluga to Fairbanks project, was not completed. In other words, were there technical reasons or economic reasons? What are your thoughts on that?
Senator Passavan, my words are to that as we just almost, just as things coincided, as ANGDA got started on Governor Palin's in, which came to be called the B2F project that is in the TAPS, Glen Allen, or Glen Highway, Richardson Corridor, At the same time, there was a parallel state in-state gas line committee started, which was called HB 369. The first chair of that was Harry Noah, who passed off to that off to a man. I believe his name was Bob Swenson, and then that now passed to current CEO of that, Dan Fowsky. Being fair, let's just say that the other group was strongly for the Parks Highway, and our funds started to dry up, and we realized quickly that since no funds were coming from the legislature or the governor to support previous Governor Palin's project, and then now Governor Sean Parnell took over, it was just eating all the funds that we had up, and we were receiving a lot of resistance, frankly, from the Corps of Engineers and BLM. They just kept coming back at us with revisions, and it was going to dry up all our money. And we just stopped because the flavor of the state two years ago got behind Mr. Fowsky and what's now called HB 369, kind of morphed now into HB 9. We just ran out of support, and we ran out of funds.
Okay, Senator French has a question.
Well, how much longer, hey, Scott, how much longer is the Glenn Richardson route than the Parks Highway route?
Hi, Hollis. Senator French, through the chair, if I could and if it's possible, I'd really like to ask now that, to get the help of my contractors, and the gentleman to answer that one would be Odie Odsather, who's up at the Fairbanks LIO. I think if you ask Senator, he'll come online and can answer some of those distance questions, and those are very important questions.
Yes, I know that Odie is online, so if are you available?
I am available.
Please state your name and affiliation, and then if you can answer Senator French's question, the floor is yours.
Yes, the name is Odie Odsather, contractor with ANGA, and I'm in Fairbanks. And the question was, which of the two lines is longer in general?
Well, I think I know the answer to that. How much longer is it?
About 30 miles.
That's all. Okay, 30 miles. And
ANGA is shorter. ANGA is shorter.
You say ANGA. You got to tell me which one you mean.
The line that goes through Glen Allen to Delta to North Pole.
Is shorter than the Parks Highway route?
Yes, sir.
And
would you please explain that?
Yeah, because I guess I didn't know that.
Okay, the distance for the Glen Toke North Pole line is about 437 miles, and the distance for the milepost 39 Dunbar to Fort Greeley is 467 miles.
Dunbar to Fort Greeley.
Yes, sir. There's three military bases that are involved here, so you got to make them all equal.
Maybe my question wasn't clear. I was wanting to compare a line from Big Lake to Fairbanks versus a line from Fairbanks to the nearest pipeline if you come down the Richardson and then the Glen.
Okay, then take off 20 miles for it.
I couldn't hear the second half.
You broke up there.
Nope, you broke up.
We're both breaking up.
All right, subtract 25 miles.
From what?
Subtract 25 miles from the 467 miles for the line going up through Dunbar. It's 25 miles from, say, like Big Lake to milepost 38 on the NSTAR line.
I got a head cold, so yeah. My ability to do numbers today is just awful. Maybe let me just ask you a real clear question, and you can do the best you can. How many miles is it? How many pipeline miles is it from Big Lake to Fairbanks up the Parks Highway?
All right. Write down some numbers because I don't have a calculator.
Okay.
Okay, it's 257 miles from Milepost 39 to Dunbar. And subtract 25 miles from that.
Okay, I get 200.
At 39.
And hold on.
39 miles.
Hold on. We got to go a little bit at a time. So everybody listening at home can file. You gave me 257. I'm subtracting 25. That's 232 miles.
Okay, now add 39 miles to get you from Dunbar to the University Experimental Farm Fields.
Okay, slow down. So that I get 271 out of that. So you're telling me it's 271 miles from Big Lake to Fairbanks?
Okay, I'll go for that.
Well, I'm asking you, sir. Okay, so if it's 271 miles from Big Lake to Fairbanks, how many miles is it to get from the nearest pipeline you can touch in the grid that connects Anchorage to Fairbanks through the Glen Highway, Richardson Highway route?
Okay, I'm going to have to back you up on your question and fill you in for some more information.
Okay.
Because to make them equal, you have to go from Fairbanks out to Fort Greely to pick up the three military bases.
Well, I mean,
if you want to make them equal, you got to include the three military bases.
Why do I got to do that?
Well, part of the three anchor tenants are Fort Wainwright, Eielson Air Force Base, and Fort Greely.
And how much gas?
Major tenants.
And how much gas do they burn?
These people refuse to look at them.
Okay.
However, the B2F line includes them.
I see. So you're saying to the 271 from Big Lake to Fairbanks, I've got to add enough pipe to touch Wainwright, Eielson, and Greeley. If we all agree that's an important, if we all agree that's something we have to do.
Yes, sir. In other words, if you want to make them equal, you have to do that.
Well, no. I mean, it's only after we decide that it's so important that we've got to run a pipe to, say, Fort Greeley that we're gonna spend money to do it. First of all, you got to decide how much they each cost, sort of without that, and then you go from there, right?
I wouldn't do it that way.
Well, I guess you and I have a difference of opinion, my friend.
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Senator Wagner has a question.
Yeah, I understand what they're saying. They say to get to the three bases, and if you go up Parks Highway, you got to add the distance.
You got
to
come back around
Fairbanks back down to the bases. However, you don't necessarily have to add that distance. I think it's what we need to do is what's it take to get to Fairbanks? If the bases want the gas, they can take a supply line from wherever the hub is established and run their own line down to service the bases. I mean, it isn't up to the state of Alaska to build a supply line for the federal bases.
Maybe Uncle Sam can build it.
There you go. That's what I would say about that.
Senator Passavant, this is Scott Hayworth. Could I jump in here, sir?
Certainly. What is your comment?
Let's agree that Mr. Odesather and Senator French came to an agreement, and I understand your question completely, Hollis. We came to the 271 miles. Taking aside, you asked a pipeline distance. You didn't ask about population. To give you your answer, our nearest check-in point on the Glen Richardson Highway, which we use in that right-of-way I told you about, is around Palmer, and to get to NSTAR, we'll back that into the NSTAR system. So you start at 0 miles, and it's 9 to Palmer, and then it's 151 up to Glen Allen from there, and then you go Canada, these different cities. You add 14, 15, 51, 75, 12, 80, that's the Eielson, and then the North Pole, and into Fairbanks. If Mr. Odesather could add that number up, you would have your answer. In mileage period, to get from Palmer, Alaska, to North Pole and NSTAR, versus their route that goes from Milepost 39, NSTAR, and goes at Dunbar over into the UA campus. So we've reached Fairbanks from two different directions.
Senator Wagner,
okay,
has a question.
Maybe we can simplify this thing, just boil it down to the simplest basis. I think this is what Senator French wanted. What is the mileage, and leave the bases out of it and everything else, what's the mileage up the Parks Highway from the hub currently in the valley to Fairbanks, and what's the mileage going around to the Glen
and up to Fairbanks?
That is the correct question. Can you help them, Mr. Odie?
Sure. The number that you have now, taking out the 25 miles, I think it was, what, 271?
271.
Okay, and to go around the other way, to get to North Pole, it's 437.
437.
And the reason for that is because it includes all three military bases.
Okay, but
I would suggest we go on to another topic. Yeah,
well, I have an important next. I have another simple question, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
How big a pipe were you going to lay? How big was the pipe? How many inches was it? 8, 12, 16, 24?
Okay. From Palmer to Delta, it was 24. And from Delta to North Pole, it was a 10.
Thank you.
And was the 24 from Delta to into Palmer, that was for the lateral from the 48-inch line that was anticipated to go into Canada?
Yes.
Okay. Someday you turn it around and come back, just like we're thinking about on this pipeline.
Yes, a totally reversible pipeline.
Is there a benefit or a cost effect if you build a gas line next to a railroad? In other words, the Parks Road. Who would it?
You're asking me that question?
Mr. Hayworth, are you capable of answering that?
I'll throw it back. OD, he's asking you. Can you answer the question, please?
Well, sure. If you can get the permit from the, you know, the highway or from the railroad, fine. There are some places where it may be difficult, and I haven't researched those, but say going through the Denali State Park, the highway goes through what they call an omnibus road. And the subsurface of that omnibus road is owned by the state of, or by the federal government, not by the state. So if you go outside of the limits of the highway, there may have to be some negotiations to go on with the federal government. Sorry, depending on where it is, I don't know if I can answer your question for you.
I guess my question was more general in nature. Is it a good thing or a bad thing to have a railroad close?
Senator,
I wouldn't, in my personal question, I'd move it off the edge of the toe slope of the railroad or the road, because that's the greatest thaw area going on and least stable.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Thomas, any comments or observations? Or
just in general?
Just in general.
Sure, maybe at least a couple, I guess. Thank you. Senator Joe Thomas, District D. I guess regarding the conversation you've just been having about the B2F line, actually those milos are, and of course that was at one time considered fairly important, and it was a plastic pipe that was going to go from Delta into Fairbanks, the reduced size pipe, because it was actually anticipating that the line would come down through Fairbanks anyhow, so you put in a plastic line from Delta there, and when the big line was built, you took up the plastic line, and you had your existing line that went from Delta into whatever connection was made at Palmer or Big Lake or wherever that might be, went into the system. So that's realistically what that was about. The mileages are, after you got that sorted around a little bit, they pretty much made sense, but you can take, you know, the Parks Highway is 365 miles from Anchorage to Fairbanks, so you're 39 or roughly 30-some miles north of that. So if you run right into Fairbanks, you just take 30 miles off of that, and you got about a 335-mile pipeline gets you to Fairbanks coming that way, roughly anyhow. So that's the difference, and those are the ideas. And, of course, this pipeline that is intended, 215, would be on the Parks Highway with the expectation that at some point in time there is a major pipeline coming from the North Slope through the interior, whether it goes down the highway ever based on the cost of gas or whether it goes to Tidewater in Valdez particularly would be the indication. So it's kind of a line that serves almost any purpose of any line that comes through the state of Alaska.
Senator French has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm a big supporter of this idea, and so I mean this, you know, and I'm a big supporter of gas pipelines, but I sometimes look at, you know, getting North Slope gas off the North Slope to market as being a project so big that it's very hard to pinpoint when it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And so I sometimes, and I really, that's why I think we're thinking about going from where we have gas to where we need it, to the interior. And I'm just wondering if you've thought about using plastic pipe for a short-term fix. How much gas can you move with plastic pipe? I don't know, but I'm just curious.
Well,
Senator Francis, this is Scott Hayworth, and thank you for the question. We about the PCV, as you mentioned, we have done some research into that. There's a lot of freezing cold factors and different things like that. Perhaps I could go as far as to say sometimes if it was going down the Glen Richardson Taps corridor, as the oil line goes right now, it's very close to some of these either bases or Golden Valley, et cetera. Maybe you could use PVC pipe. If I could, Senator French, if I could just add that to be fair to things, and just so we get a really good picture here, and just to put a picture into your gentlemen's minds, there is an existing NSTAR line that goes to Big Lake. It's got an 18-inch tap at the end of it. You could come off of that and proceed north on the Parks Highway and come into Dunbar and Enana and get into Fairbanks and North Pole. That might be a short, call it a Big Lake, it's all still a B2F because you got a B in there. That I don't want to say that is not a possibility that needs to be looked at to get Cook Inlet gas up there. But what I would really like to convey, Senator French and through the chair to the rest of the committee is this idea. If you're going to come off the North Slope with the ASAP pipeline, which would mean at Live and Good you come down and go through Minto and get to Dunbar, and then you cut over with what they're calling a lateral. It's 39 miles to the UAA campus, as Mr. Odesafer said. And then you keep going in increments to get to Fairbanks is another 20, and North Pole and Eielson with all this lateral, maybe smaller 10-inch pipeline. And you come all the way down to, say, Delta Junction and on down further. If you get a visual picture in your mind, why would you just come down to Dunmar? And if you start over with this lateral going all the way up to North Pole, why don't you just now then smartly continue down the Glen Richardson at that point, and now you are hitting all the military bases and hitting everything. So you can kind of see the picture of that. Live and Good down to Dunbar, east over all the way to Golden Valley and North Pole, and then pick up our route that we've worked on and come on down into Palmer. That's a much cheaper, efficient pipeline that catches everybody. So we got to start, you know, thinking out of the box a little bit about this.
Scott, I appreciate your answer, but I'd asked Senator Thomas a fairly simple question, just because I'm just trying to get to bedrock here. You've been thinking and working on this for years, and you probably know a lot more about the nuances than I do. Well, we're just trying to get up to speed, and sometimes I just think, what's the quickest, cheapest solution? So, Senator Thomas, do you know anything about my question about plastic pipe?
Certainly. Senator Joe Thomas, through the chair, Senator French, realistically, it's shorter. Actually, the only base you would leave out if you came from mile 39 and went up the Richardson Highway by building about a 340-mile pipeline would be Greeley, because you could get to Eielson. You're right at Fort Wayne, right, by just going,
If you go up the Parks, I think you said Richardson.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. Yeah, if you go up the Parks, you would continue on from Dunbar. You get into Fairbanks. And then you build the 39-mile spur, and if we're taking the numbers we were just given before, you add another 20 miles to that spur, and you're out at Eielson, basically. It's almost what it amounts to. So realistically, you got 340-mile pipeline there versus a 450-460 miles. We'd have to refine those numbers a little bit. And yet you could build that plastic pipe. That stuff's tough as nails anymore. And so realistically, short term, if you figured that at a later date you were going to probably have an in-state line of some type, and this one would last long enough, if that in-state line came all the way through the state, then you're talking about going from Glen Allen over to Palmer. And if you're talking about an in-state line, or not an in-state line, but a line that went down the highway like we were talking about earlier in this meeting and earlier at the Lunch and Learn, then you would build, you would still have the connection, relatively the same connection, and you might upgrade that to a steel pipe depending on what else is developed and what your needs are at that point in time. So realistically, you certainly could. You could build a plastic pipe from Palmer up the Parks Highway and get it all the way out to the refinery and to Golden Valley's location, as well as Fort Wainwright and Eielson, if need be.
It's just last week we heard from Mr. Dooler, who was giving us some super high numbers about how this might work out, and I think a lot of us are scratching our heads. And I guess before we get to the end of the session, it'd be interesting to know how much gas you can move through, you know, 12-inch plastic pipe. You'd have a trench there. You could put a bigger pipe in when you decide to come the other direction when that happens. But every year I think that, you know, I mean, Fairbanks is going to wait, I don't know how long, for steel pipe to get there from the North Slope. And I think we can't wait that long.
Through the chair, Senator French, I believe that probably somebody already has that calculation, what size pipe you could build as a temporary fix getting it to Fairbanks, and I believe that a 10 or 12-inch pipe would be more than enough gas to get that accomplished.
And then you could wait, because it's going to be, how many years will it take Fairbanks to build the necessary build-out? I mean, just getting gas to Fairbanks, every single house has got to convert. You've got to lay a whole bunch of distribution lines. This is a long-term project. It's not going to happen overnight. Doesn't matter how that gas gets there. You could bring a BCF a day to the edge of Fairbanks, and there's a whole bunch of homeowners that are going to have to start converting their furnaces, and a local distribution company is going to have to start building a pipeline.
That's correct.
Senator Wagner.
Sure. I think what we probably should do, we can sit and talk about where we're going to go with this gas. Let's worry about getting the gas to Fairbanks first and just establishing a location for a hub, if that's what we want to do. Let's get to the hub. If Livengood got a mine out there, they can come in the hub and pick it up and get their own pipe. I mean, that's the way pipelines do things. They don't put all these supply lines out there. They let the whoever has a certificate of public convenience, the one that does that. So if we're going to look at a pipeline, what we need to do is from point A to point B, let everybody else worry about the distribution, because that's the small, small, small part of the thing. The main thing is to get the gas up into that area. And what do we do with this pipeline, or one from the North Slope, or one from Nenana Basin, if we pass that bill and they happen to hit some gas there, doesn't matter. Just getting it to the point of distribution and then go from there.
I think that's accurate, and it does not need to be a 24-inch line between Fairbanks and Big Lake. You know, that's only if you want to, so to speak, pre-construct the lateral, so that if there is a large diameter 48-inch line either to export, for example, at Valdez or going through Canada, then you would potentially want to have that lateral off of that 48-inch line. But Fairbanks in and of itself, potentially, as Senator Thomas indicates, a 10-inch or a 12-inch line would meet all of our likely future needs. And maybe if we do get a lot of growth, maybe a second line if that's what it takes. But, again, something to get the energy relief as promptly as possible to interior Alaska and as quickly as can possibly be. Senator.
Yeah, you're going to find out using that plastic of it. You know, whether it's a 10 or a 12 or a 14-inch line or whatever you use, the cost going up to sizing it up isn't going to be that much more. So you don't want to do two lines. You want to do one line that's going to take care of all the needs up there, no matter what we do. We don't want to run parallel lines up there. So that's when you make the difference between the plastic and the steel. But I think we need to think about one other thing, and it's supposed to be coming up the end of this week. Now, the governor said that he has a deadline, and that deadline is the end of this month. And I'm just kind of sitting here waiting. I want to see what the governor comes up with. That's a date that he said he wants something back from the major. So I want to see what they come back with. Maybe all this talk is for naught. I hope it is. I'm not sure.
Senator Pascoe.
Well, we have to transition now away from Senate Bill 215. We now, thank you, Senator Thomas, we need to now take up Senate Bill 209. So any comments, Senator Wilikowski, that you'd like to make before we turn to the invited testimony?
I don't have any additional comments, Mr. Chair. I've just gotten a lot of favorable feedback on the bill since word has come out about it. I I think it's an important bill. I think it's a bill that will help put more oil in the pipeline, Mr. Chairman. That's the only reason I'm filing it. I think if a field's not profitable, then a company doesn't have to develop it. If a field is profitable, and then the lease requires it be developed, and that's all we're saying with the enforcement provision, Mr. Chairman. If there are tweaks that need to be done to meet the concerns that parties have, happy to do that. But the goal is simply to try to get more oil in the pipeline, which I know is a concern shared by everyone in the legislature.
Thank you. We will now turn to the off-net. Kara, are you available? Kara in Anchorage.
I'm sorry, Senator. The phone paused there. I didn't hear you ask for me. Co-Chairman Pasvan and Wagner, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, commonly referred to as AOGA. I want to thank you for the invitation and ability to testify today on Senate Bill 209, and I do apologize that I was not able to be in Juneau today. So thank you for allowing me to call in. For the record, and as I've stated before, AOGA is a business trade association. Our mission is to foster the long-term viability of the oil and gas industry for the benefit of all Alaskans. Our 16-member companies represent the breadth and scope of the industry here, and my member companies have interests all across Alaska, both onshore and offshore, both on state land and federal land. As I've mentioned in previous testimony, AOGA's members hold active leases for more than 1.2 million acres of state land. AOGA does not support Senate Bill 209. This bill was described as being a, quote, pro-development bill that simply seeks to get more oil in the pipeline, unquote, and the bill sponsor just reiterated that statement. But we respectfully and emphatically disagree. We think this bill would do the exact opposite and kill development before it even has a chance of happening, because it will have a chilling effect on the very first step in the development process, the leasing program. So I'd like to briefly just talk about our current leasing program and the differences between leasing and licensing. The current leasing system in Alaska is an auction system that is used on state land and is also used on federal lands in the Gulf of Mexico, offshore Alaska, and the National Petroleum Reserve. For state leases, the areas offered are quite small. By law, a lease cannot be more than 5,760 acres or 9 square miles. The bid variable for the auction is almost always a cash bonus. The bonus is calculated by multiplying the number of dollars per acre bid by the number of acres contained in the lease. Whoever bids the most for each lease wins the exclusive rights to explore on that lease for the term of the lease. Every activity that is carried out on the lease requires permits. No permits are granted or lately even guaranteed as a result of the bidding process. This bill seems to shift the current leasing program into a licensing program. Licensing is used around the world and comes in many different variations. Typically, very large areas of land are made available to be licensed by competing companies. The licenses are often awarded based on the work commitment made. There is typically no cash bonus. The winner is determined by how much work and often the kind of work the potential licensee is willing to do. Licenses are awarded, again, for only very large tracts of land, and the jurisdiction usually provides seismic information and awards permits in a much more expedient manner versus Alaska, where state and federal permits usually take years, not months. I think it's important to note that Alaska has had a licensing program for frontier exploration areas for almost 20 years. Licenses are available for up to 500,000 acres of land and are based on a work commitment, and there is no bonus bid. It's further important to note that the current state licensing program is and was created, again, for the exploration basins, not the producing provinces. So it is current statute that licensing cannot be used in the Cook Inlet or on most areas of the North Slope. When our current area-wide leasing program was established, it was clear the administration and legislature at that time saw the need for both systems, and the legislature did not want to give up the bonus bids in those areas. In fact, the state's area-wide leasing program is one of the few bright spots of doing business in Alaska from an oil and gas company's perspective, because our current area-wide leasing program is very consistent. We believe Senate Bill 209 would create administrative burdens that will likely alter the certainty for timing and awarding of bids. Additionally, a number of licenses have been awarded throughout the years, and wells have been drilled in these exploration frontier basins, but I'd like to point out that no production has yet resulted from a license. So back, as I mentioned, licensing is usually for large areas of land, and we did some research, and in evaluating an upcoming licensing round in Greenland, the entire licensing area is about 50,000 square kilometers. The individual licenses will be available within that area range, in that area, will range from about 420,000 acres to almost 1 million acres, 940,000 acres. By comparison, the entire Prudhoe Bay field is about 215,000 acres. So the smallest license available is about twice the size of the entire Prudhoe Bay oil field. So additionally, another way to compare it is the smallest license available in Greenland would contain about 72 state leases. If the state wants to turn our current area-wide leasing program into a licensing program, then we would encourage the state to evaluate all facets of a licensing program, such as providing much more seismic information up front and expediting the permitting process. So taking a look at this last area-wide lease sale, which was held on December 7, 2011, Pearl Harbor Day, the state received over $14 million in high bonus bids and leased almost 335,000 acres and 178 different tracts of land. Two currently producing companies participated in this sale. Longtime Alaska company ConocoPhillips won 34 tracts, and one of the state's smallest producers, Pioneer Natural Resources, submitted one bid, which it obtained for one tract. The other companies that participated were Royal Energy, Great Bear Petroleum, Repsol, 70th and 148th, which is a division of Armstrong Oil and Gas, Woodstone Resources, Savant Alaska, Alaska LLC, and individuals such as Dan Dunkel, Samuel Cade, Paul Gavora, Andrew Bachner, and Keith Forgrisgren. I think it's important to note that the two most recent producing fields, Ugric and Nikaichuk, were originally leases that were obtained by one of these smaller companies, and those original leases were eventually sold and or partnered with a company to explore and produce that area. Following the lease sale in December, the Commissioner of Natural Resources, Dan Sullivan, quoted as saying, quote, "It was quite a respectable showing. However, I would say that there were some companies that I thought would show up who didn't. It's always hard to know why," unquote. Commissioner Sullivan went on to say, quote, "These lease sales are just the first inning of a long-term strategy. Here is the issue. We recognize the status quo is not working, and a critical part of our five-point plan is tax reform," unquote. Even though the state received 219 bids for the North Slope area-wide lease sale, I think it's important to note that no bids were submitted for the same lease sale in the Foothills area. Senate Bill 209 says that for each lease a company wants to submit a bid for, that the bidder must submit a plan of development for that lease. So, for this last North Slope area-wide lease sale, 219 individual bids were received, and as I mentioned, 178 tracts were sold. Under this legislation, the above bidders would have had to submit 219 individual plans of development for evaluation. Royale Energy would have had to submit 87 different plans of development, Great Bear, 32, and Repsol, 26. AOGA finds it hard to believe that especially these smaller companies or any company would have the ability and resources to submit detailed plans of development prior to submitting a bid for lease. The same concern rings true not only for the North Slope, but for Cook Inlet as well. Cook Inlet is experiencing a resurgence of interest, and requiring a plan of development prior to a lease sale, we feel would be impractical and unnecessary. In addition, this bill would require companies to provide their own interpretation of each lease prior to bidding and determine how they will develop each lease without having the opportunity to evaluate each lease. The company may have and will likely have limited seismic data and may not have access to all the current well data, if it any exists at all. The bidder may be working from a geologic concept that can't be tested until they actually have the lease in hand and are able to evaluate it. That's what exploration is for, to test what is actually there, much in the same way Repsol is currently doing with their leases on state land and what Shell is trying to do in the offshore. A company should not be forced into making unnecessary commitments before it has a robust opportunity to evaluate and understand what the potential of the lease might be. So again, not one of my member companies believes this bill will result in more development or put more oil in the pipeline. On the contrary, we believe that forcing companies to perform this intrusive exercise will do nothing more than drive out the very explorers Alaska is trying to attract. So I want to thank you again for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to take any questions the committee may have.
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Yeah, more of a comment, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the testimony, and maybe we be happy to work with AOGA to try to craft a little better language, because it was not our intent to require plans of development like the plans of development are required currently when a company is getting a unit approved. Rather, the intent was for a company to come forward with some minimum work commitments so that you don't get a situation where a company goes ahead. We really have speculators coming in and acquiring leases to just hold on to them with really no intention of developing. Rather, what we were trying to do, and I'll go back and look at the language a little more carefully, was we were trying to get some just very minimum commitments from companies that they actually do intend in a certain time frame to go out and do some sort of seismic testing or drilling, and that would be included in the terms by the commissioner. The commissioner would go ahead and set some minimum work commitments. So we're not saying that detailed plans of development have to be prepared, and maybe we need to go back and tweak the language a little bit to ensure that that's the case, Mr. Chairman. But happy to work with AOGA on that language, and thank you.
Kara, if you could please submit a copy of that written testimony so that we can have that be entered as part of the official record, and that would be much appreciated.
Senator Pavan, happy to do so.
All right, thank you very much. And also for the record, the Department of Natural Resources Division of Oil and Gas has been invited to testify upon this bill, and the Division of Oil and Gas and the Department of Law will offer their comments, and so I would suggest to the bill sponsor that if there are law change or language changes that you're thinking about, to getting those to the Department of Oil and Gas and the Department of Law so that we can have the most comments upon the most updated information and Given that we have a David Stone from Yakutat, I believe, do you want to provide some testimony upon?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please state your
name. Hey, I'm not sure who the chair is, but I want to thank you both, or both chairs and the rest of the committee for listening. I read 209, and I'm...
Sir, if you could please state... Could you please...
Can't hear. Excuse me?
Could you please state your name and affiliation?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, my name is David Stone. I'm the mayor of Yakutat. I'm in Yakutat, Alaska.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Yes, I just, as the previous person said, that our resources for the development and benefit of Alaska, and I agree there. But I don't agree that leases, they're not designed to be a store of value and not developed until it's practically. It's, our leases are designed to be developed, and if they, many of you people went to Norway, and their motto is you develop it in a reasonable time, or the leases are null and void. Right now, a number of companies are, well, for example, there should never be another Point Thompson. 4 decades, and now the state's spending a fortune on lawsuits trying to get them to develop land that if it was not developable when they bought it, then they should have gave the lease up. There's many small developers that want to get on some of this land, and it's being tied up by the big three, and like I said, it's not a store of value, and I want to thank you all for listening to my ramping.
Thank you, Mayor Stone, for your comments. Any questions for Mayor Stone?
No, I just want to, this is Senator Wagner. Hello, David. Thanks for coming in and testifying.
How you doing?
Good.
Well, that concludes the hearing today. We will adjourn Senate resources for March 26th.